This is Jay Sekulow, the ACLJ, back at the ICC, this time defending the interests of Israel.
Live from Washington, D.C., Jay Sekulow Live. Phone lines are open for your questions right now. Call 1-800-684-3110. That's 1-800-684-3110. And now, Chief Counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice, Jay Sekulow.
Hey everybody, welcome to the broadcast. We're going to be taking your calls at 800-684-3110, 1-800-684-3110. We've got a lot to discuss today because there's a lot going on. I want to mention at the beginning, and we'll get to it in the next segment of the broadcast, we had major news development out of a case out of the International Criminal Court. You'll know, remember, we were at the ICC, presented oral arguments back in December. It seems like a lifetime ago. Lots happened since then. I've had a lot of hearings since then. But we had a hearing in December at the International Criminal Court. There, the issue was whether the United States could be put into or included within proceedings that were really targeting terrorists, but they were trying to get the United States involved. We fought back on that. We presented oral arguments in that case, so that was in December. Don't have a decision yet. There's been another case brewing that involves Israel. We are also involved in that and involved in that heavily. And that is not going to require a brief of about 30 pages in length. So it's quite a legal document that we're going to be getting into. Before we get into that, though, I wanted to go to Than Bennett and discuss some issues that are coming up legislatively that the ACLJ is working. We just filed a brief, by the way, in the Supreme Court in a pro-life case, June Medical Services versus Rebecca G. She's the Secretary of the Louisiana Department of Health and Human Services. We filed the brief. This involves abortion doctors having to be required to have access to medical facility privileges. But Than, you've got some major legislation coming. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it really relates to that case as well, Jay. I mean, the tie-in here is that the pro-abortion left in Washington, D.C. has moved beyond abortion, Jay. I mean, now there are two extreme things like denying admitting privileges. They're also denying care for children who have already been born. And Jay, this administration and Leader McConnell have made it a very intentional effort to make sure that these extremes are highlighted. Next Tuesday, Jay, in the United States Senate, Leader McConnell is going to call up two very important bills that lay out just how extreme the pro-abortion left is here in D.C. The first one is called the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. Jay, essentially that piece of legislation would ban abortions after 20 weeks. And the reason for that is there is medical consensus that it is that point that a child can feel pain. Most of the research, Jay, says it's early, but there is medical consensus at that 20-week period. So that's the first piece. And the second piece, Jay, it's not about abortion at all. It's about babies that are born alive. This is a bill that is sponsored by Senator Sasse and says that if a baby is born alive, laying on the table, he or she has to have the same medical care that a child of that age in any other situation would have. Jay, there were only three Democrats in the United States Senate that supported this the next time around. They will have their next chance on Tuesday. Yeah. It needs 60 votes to proceed, but both will get a vote.
Yeah, well, at least they're getting votes. I think it brings some attention to it. We're going to get into that in the last segment of the program, kind of the cases in the pro-life area that we're working on. But also, I want to go back to the situation in Israel. So the ICC prosecutor is trying to basically, through a legal process, Harry, very quickly here, create an environment where the court decides that the Palestinian Authority is the Palestine becomes a state.
Absolutely. So basically, the prosecutor is trying to abrogate and ignore all international norms with respect to the creation of statehood. And in essence, the prosecutor, who has been, I think, consistently anti-Israel, is simply pushing a dream by many Israeli and many groups that oppose the nation state of Israel and essentially oppose the nation state of Israel remaining a Jewish state.
Yeah, that's the biggest part of it. All right, we're going to be joined by Skip Ash, who heads up our international law group and our law of armed conflict. Skip will be joining us in the next segment of the program. We're taking your calls as well, 1-800-684-3110, 800-684-3110. So we'll take your calls about Israel, about the life issue, and we're going to have a lot more ahead. Let me encourage you also to support the work of the ACLJ. We are close, not quite, close to where we were last year in the month of February. We're about 2% behind, to be specific. So your support of the ACLJ makes a huge difference. We encourage you, if you're listening to this broadcast and want to support the work of the ACLJ, do it today at aclj.org.
The challenges facing Americans are substantial. At a time when our values, our freedoms, our constitutional rights are under attack, it's more important than ever to stand with the American Center for Law and Justice. For decades now, the ACLJ has been on the front lines, protecting your freedoms, defending your rights, in courts, in Congress, and in the public arena. And we have an exceptional track record of success. But here's the bottom line. We could not do our work without your support. We remain committed to protecting your religious and constitutional freedoms. That remains our top priority, especially now during these challenging times. The American Center for Law and Justice is on your side. If you're already a member, thank you. And if you're not, well, this is the perfect time to stand with us at aclj.org, where you can learn more about our life-changing work. Become a member today, aclj.org. Only when a society can agree that the most vulnerable and voiceless deserve to be protected is there any hope for that culture to survive. And that's exactly what you are saying when you stand with the American Center for Law and Justice to defend the right to life. We've created a free, powerful publication offering a panoramic view of the ACLJ's battle for the unborn. It's called Mission Life. It will show you how you are personally impacting the pro-life battle through your support. And the publication includes a look at all major ACLJ pro-life cases, how we're fighting for the rights of pro-life activists, the ramifications of Roe v. Wade 40 years later, Planned Parenthood's role in the abortion industry, and what Obamacare means to the pro-life movement. Discover the many ways your membership with the ACLJ is empowering the right to life. Request your free copy of Mission Life today online at aclj.org/gift.
At 800-684-3110. Back to the ICC. So I want to put this into context for you. We are the American Center for Law and Justice, through our European Center for Law and Justice affiliate in Strasbourg, France, is going to be filing a brief with the International Criminal Court in The Hague. A order was issued yesterday or day before, and it is rather lengthy because there's a lot of people participating. But I want to go to Skip Ash, who is our senior counsel in charge of our international affairs section of the ACLJ, to also talk about what this case involves. You're seeing on the screen, those are watching on Facebook and Periscope, those are the documents, the initial documents of the order, and as well as our initial submission. Skip, let's talk about what this is different than the issue we had in previously. We just finished up in The Hague in December, was it 4th, 5th, and 6th? It does seem like 100 years ago.
It certainly does.
It's for me, anyways. I mean, I lied, but I've had a lot of hearings in the last, would you say? Probably had more hearings in the last 2 months than I've had in my life for various clients, including well-known ones. But we had the hearing for 3 days at The Hague, and let's talk about what that case involved, and then we'll get into what this new case is. The case of The Hague that we dealt with involved U.S. issues, military specifically.
That's correct. It involved potential or alleged crimes committed by U.S. personnel in Afghanistan. So we went there to defend the U.S. Army, Navy, Marines, Coast Guardsmen, everybody who was involved in any actions in Afghanistan. We went there to defend U.S. forces because we are not a state party to that treaty, and therefore that treaty should have no jurisdiction over any U.S. nationals. So we were there to defend U.S. nationals. This other one now is a similar thing where they're trying to go after Israeli nationals who are also not members of the treaty.
Yeah, there's more to it than that, though, on this one. We're going to get into that in a minute. But, Harry, we've had serious criticism of the International Criminal Court's reach of attempts at reaching jurisdiction outside what the statute authorizes. That's been a consistent concern at the ACLJ. We've got a team that deals with the ICC. I mean, it's very important to have a voice there because it's a court that has a big impact. But there's been concerns about the jurisdictional reach here.
Absolutely. So essentially, the prosecutor asserts that the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, those are not part of Israel, according to the prosecutor. So it's important to keep in mind that the state of Israel, in terms of human history, has existed for thousands of years. Yeah, the modern state of Israel was created pursuant to a United Nations mandate in 1947, which took effect in 1948. And then thirdly, pursuant to international law and the rules of war, Israel has taken additional territory. But what the prosecutor has essentially done is attempt to reverse the process. In other words, bureaucrats and social justice warriors in Brussels or The Hague, they get to decide what constitutes the precise territory of Israel, and they now seek to enforce norms that are decided by the International Criminal Court against the state of Israel, even though the state of Israel is not a signatory. So they want to press a button, erase history, and then magically create the state of Israel. I'm sorry, the state of Palestine, and cause the state of Israel to disappear.
So in this particular case, Skip, so people understand is the prosecutor has filed an intent to conduct an investigation. And she's preparing her team to investigate what she calls war crimes and crimes against humanity allegedly committed by Israelis against Palestinians. The question is, who submitted this request for representation, but also what constitutes the Palestinian state? Is part of the concern here that she may well try to get the court to decide the statehood of the territory known as the Palestinian territory?
I think that's precisely what she hopes to accomplish, because if the court were to say that territory X, Y, and Z was legitimately a part of this so-called state of Palestine, then she would have the jurisdictional reach to go after any Israeli crimes or alleged Israeli crimes that took place in those places. So I think that's exactly what she hopes will come out of this, and this would be the Palestinians gaining statehood through the back door, because remember, in the Oslo Accords, they agreed that these issues, the issue of borders and territory and everything else, would be decided via bilateral negotiations with the Israelis, and they don't get what they want from the Israelis because they're not willing to give and take in these negotiations, and therefore they're trying a different way, and they're trying now to use the ICC as a means of getting recognition of their state.
You know, we have a call coming in from Ed I want to take, and we're taking your calls and comments, by the way, on Facebook and Periscope, or you can call us at 800-684-3110. But let's take Ed's call on line 4. Ed, go ahead. Ed? Nope. We'll go back to Ed and see if Ed's either there. We may have a little technical issue on our end. I wanted to go to Than on this, and there was a lot of movement at the end of the Obama administration, Than, on issues involving Israel. And even when the incoming administration was requesting not to make final decisions, they did anyways.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is what Skip was alluding to. First of all, let me just set the foundation with this, Jay. I mean, these international bodies are always trying to get these footholds of jurisdiction against either Israel or the United States. But on this issue of Palestinian statehood, I think Skip is absolutely correct to call this a backdoor approach, because it was at the very, very end of the Obama administration that they walked away from longstanding U.S. policy that the United States would veto a resolution on this issue of statehood at the Security Council. They declined to veto that, so that resolution went forward. And Jay, I think that gave the Palestinian Authority the thought that maybe they would win it in that jurisdiction. Of course, then you had a change of administration, and this administration, the Trump administration, quickly walked that back. And so I really think that's why they're taking this issue to the International Criminal Court. Of course, the United States is not a party, but Jay, this is why we take these issues seriously. This is why we show up, even though it is in many ways enemy territory, because you can't really have something that's more important to a nation's self-determination than their sovereignty. We're going to show up and defend that.
Skip wrote a blog that's up at aclj.org. I think it's the lead blog on the website right now, and in it says this. Late last month, the prosecutor took the first step. She submitted a request to a panel of ICC judges seeking from them an answer concerning what territory claimed by Palestinians, they call them occupied territories, what would actually constitute the so-called state of Palestine. So has she actually, skipped, asked the judges to make the determination as to borders?
Well, actually, what she has done is she has said, I believe, speaking her, she says, I believe that the borders of the state of Palestine are actually East Jerusalem to include the West Bank, as they existed in 1967 prior to the Six-Day War. So what she would like is for them to say that all of that territory is legitimately the so-called state of Palestine. And if she were to get that, that would be a major problem for the Israelis. And it would be, it would be something that would be really cause great mischief throughout the Middle East.
But, I mean, also the idea, Harry, that a court would make this political determination. The concerns that people have had about the International Criminal Court is because of things like this.
Absolutely. But I think it's important and imperative to remember that the ICC is dominated by global elites who wish to ignore traditional rules and essentially create new rules based on their own individuated conception of justice. So here we have a situation where the prosecutor is really asking the ICC to create the state of Palestine, which is contrary to international law, and then to impose penalties on a sovereign nation, the state of Israel, for alleged war crimes and humanitarian violations. So this is a breathtaking power grab by an individual who does not have the power under international law. So essentially, this is all fictional, but if the ICC accepts this fictional claim, it does place Israel squarely in the crosshairs of the international community. And then it's more likely than not that the Palestinians will go to the Europeans and then they will say, we have this ICC decision and you cannot deal at least with the Israelis in these disputed territories.
Which tells you why it's so important for our ACLJ and European Center for Law and Justice to be there for these fights. Now, in the next segment of the broadcast, I'm going to get into what that means, because unlike in a lot of cases where it's, 10-page briefs, here it's 30 pages, which is basically almost the size of a Supreme Court brief. And also, I'm going to talk to Skip about where this goes, what the actual issues are, and what's likely to happen with this case on appeal. This is a big, big case. And this is another reason why your support of the ACLJ makes a big difference. We fund our European Center for Law and Justice out of your support for the ACLJ here. We have a full office in Strasbourg, France, that engages these issues. And as I said, we just came back, and we were there in December. And now we're going back, at least on paper. By March 16th is the due date of the brief. So support the work of the ACLJ. You can do that at aclj.org. That's aclj.org. We encourage you to support the work. As I said, we're getting close to catching up with last year in February, and we think we could actually beat it, but we need your help. ACLJ.org. We're going to be back with more from our team in just a moment.
Only when a society can agree that the most vulnerable and voiceless deserve to be protected is there any hope for that culture to survive. And that's exactly what you are saying when you stand with the American Center for Law and Justice to defend the right to life. We've created a free, powerful publication offering a panoramic view of the ACLJ's battle for the unborn. It's called Mission Life. It will show you how you are personally impacting the pro-life battle through your support. And the publication includes a look at all major ACLJ pro-life cases, how we're fighting for the rights of pro-life activists, the ramifications of Roe v. Wade 40 years later, Planned Parenthood's role in the abortion industry, and what Obamacare means to the pro-life movement. Discover the many ways your membership with the ACLJ is empowering the right to life. Request your free copy of Mission Life today online at aclj.org/gift. The challenges facing Americans are substantial. At a time when our values, our freedoms, our constitutional rights are under attack, it's more important than ever to stand with the American Center for Law and Justice. For decades now, the ACLJ has been on the front lines, protecting your freedoms, defending your rights, in courts, in Congress, and in the public arena. And we have an exceptional track record of success. But here's the bottom line: we could not do our work without your support. We remain committed to protecting your religious and constitutional freedoms. That remains our top priority, especially now during these challenging times. The American Center for Law and Justice is on your side. If you're already a member, thank you. And if you're not, well, this is the perfect time to stand with us at ACLJ.org, where you can learn more about our life-changing work. Become a member today, ACLJ.org.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. We're taking your calls at 800-684-3110, 1-800-684-3110. Skip, I want to focus in on this. We got a call coming in. I'm going to get to Ed's call in just a moment, but I want to focus in on this. Skip, what is the issue we will be addressing in our brief? And we're not the only ones, by the way. This has got a lot of groups coming in. We'll talk about that in a moment. But let's first talk about what is the issue that we will be addressing.
Well, the court has made it very narrow. The issue they want to have people discuss is basically this. Is there an entity called the State of Palestine? And if so, what are its borders? Because the prosecutor needs to know that, to know where she has jurisdiction to proceed. Since Israel is not a member, she has no jurisdiction to proceed in any territory belonging to Israel. But if Israelis are active on another state's territory, such as a so-called State of Palestine, then she would have jurisdiction if a State of Palestine actually exists.
So that, what will we be able to, because I remember this happened when we were in The Hague. There was, you know, we got attacked for being outside of the question presented, although when we made the arguments, those attacks went away because we stayed within the question presented. What will be the basis of our argument here?
Well, we're going to argue primarily the historical aspect of the fact that under uti possidetis juris, which is a concept of international law that says, in effect, when a previously non-independent state, like a colony or a mandate, gains its independence, at the very moment of independence, the state that emerges, which in this case was only Israel, gets all the territory that belonged to that previous entity. Therefore, from the very beginning, every bit of the mandate for Palestine, which is from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, should have been sovereign territory of the State of Israel. So anybody else has a claim, those claims have been taken away. But there are other arguments, too, that we're going to raise. Some is that we, during the time of the Six-Day War, when the West Bank and Gaza Strip were recaptured, they were recaptured or captured during a defensive war. The Israelis were attacked from outside, and therefore they gained territory through defensive war. That's also one of the prongs we'll argue. So there are a number of legal prongs we can use. There are a lot of them we can't use this time because they've taken, such as the fact that Israel's not a party to the statute.
Yeah, they don't want to hear that this time.
That's right. So there are some things we argued before which are critical, but they said we want to hear only about this small question. But what's significant to me is seven states who are members of the court, or members of the Rome Statute, are coming in on Israel's side.
Which is really, I want you to say that again because that's not normally what we hear. Say that again and we'll go through the states in a moment.
Yeah, there are seven states that are members of the Rome Statute who are committed to its terms, who are coming and are going to be filing briefs in support of Israel and the fact that there is no Palestinian state, or if there is one, it is not significant enough to be able to bring the charges it has brought. And that is significant, and I think that's a great encouragement.
Yeah.
On this argument.
No question. Let me give you the states. It's the countries: the Czech Republic, Germany, Australia, Austria, Brazil, Hungary, and Uganda. And then a number of NGOs will be filing. That's us. And there will be groups that are opposing. Let's go ahead and take Ed's call. He's calling on line four. We're taking your calls, too, at 800-684-3110, 800-684-3110. Ed, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call and
sure.
For what all you guys do.
Thanks.
My understanding is Resolution 2334 was allowed to pass about a month before Obama left office.
Yep.
If that's the case, Resolution 2334 says that the United Nations does not recognize Israel beyond its pre-1967 borders.
Yeah.
Now that's not a problem with the administration we have today, but if that indeed passed, is that not going to be a huge problem sometime down the road?
I'm going to let Than address it first and then Skip, because there's some aspects of that where it's still not the definitive source as to what the actual borders are, legally speaking. But go ahead, Than, first.
It's a terrific question from Ed, and this is what I referenced earlier. And we have long said that all of these issues need to be negotiated between the parties, and the Palestinian Authority has repeatedly been taking the issue to the United Nations Security Council and trying to find a remedy for them. The United States had always blocked that until, like Ed mentioned, at the end of the Obama administration when they declined to veto it. But here's why it's not over, Jay. That resolution did acknowledge the 1967 borders, like Ed said, but it didn't have the enforcement mechanisms that would follow. So the plan for the Palestinians was to go back to the Security Council to try to get some of those things, but this administration is committed to blocking them. And Jay, I really do think that is why we are seeing this at the ICC now, because they got part of their plan at the Security Council, but they know that they're blocked there now, so they're trying the back door.
So, Skip, I was going to ask you, from a legal standpoint, that would not be the end-all be-all anyways.
No, we have to look at what the authority under the UN Charter is for the Security Council. And the Security Council has no authority to set the borders of any state. And therefore, they exceeded their authority, so they can pontificate to their heart's content. But I would question the legality of this. Yep. The United States has, and other nations have too. But it's I don't think it was a lawful statement. It was a statement of policy at the time, a statement of aspirations, but I don't think it holds water legally because it exceeded the authority of the Security Council.
But this, unfortunately, though, the trend with these international bodies, Harry, and this is the consistent, the trend is that their jurisdictional limits are almost meaningless.
Yes, and so I think what you have here is a conflict, a debate, over those that want to impose, if you will, de facto statehood with respect to the state of Israel, the state of Palestine, versus those that are concerned about the de jure rules. And I think Skip and Than's analysis is absolutely accurate legally, and in my view, it's absolutely accurate factually. On the other hand, many individuals within the international community disagree. They take the view that the Palestinians ought to have a state of Israel, and they then make legal assessments grounded in the claim that the state of Palestine actually exists, even though there's no evidence of that, even though it's entirely fictional. And they now want to make legal judgments grounded in all of this fictional analysis against the state of Israel. They want to push a button and eliminate the so-called occupied territories from the jurisdiction of the state of Israel. And if we allow this to occur, the next move is to try to push a button and to cause the Jewish state of Israel to disappear.
Yeah, well, that's why we're there. That's why we're going to court. Brief is due March 16th. So we've got about 3 weeks to get that done. We've got a team working on it. 30 pages, which for them is a lot, actually, the way that they do the briefs. But Skip said, though, it's encouraging to me that the Czech Republic, Germany, Australia, Austria, Brazil, Hungary, and Uganda have already indicated that they're going to file on behalf of Israel's side. We certainly will as well. Your support of the ACLJ makes all this possible. So we encourage you to go to aclj.org and donate for our work. That includes supporting our work at the European Center for Law and Justice, which is the group that will be filing this very brief, which I am the chief counsel of, Skip's involved with, Harry's involved with. We encourage you to utilize our resources on our website, on Facebook and social media, but also support the work of the ACLJ. Do that today. You can do it at aclj.org as we have this brief. We just got word of this. We've already assembled the team. aclj.org. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
For decades now, the ACLJ has been on the front lines, protecting your freedoms, defending your rights, in courts, in Congress, and in the public arena. The American Center for Law and Justice is on your side. If you're already a member, thank you. And if you're not, well, this is the perfect time to stand with us at aclj.org, where you can learn more about our life-changing work. Become a member today, aclj.org.
Fight for the right to live in freedom. Live from Washington, D.C., Jay Sekulow Live.
And now your host, Than Bennett.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Jay Sekulow Live. Than Bennett in Washington, D.C., joined by Harry Hutchison out of our media center in Tennessee. And I want to make a quick pivot. We're going to circle back to the issue about the International Criminal Court and their effort to infringe on Israel's sovereignty in just a moment. I know Ray is holding on the line to talk about that issue, and we will circle back to it in just a moment. But I want to circle back to the state of play inside the Democrat primary and politics in general. Of course, we are on the eve of the Nevada caucus. Now, Nevada residents have had an opportunity to cast early votes, and this is going to get pretty confusing, folks, because when they went into the ballot room to cast their ballot, they had to pick up to five preferences in order of their preference. And tomorrow, when these caucuses take place, Nevada will be trying to attempt to follow those ballots. So if a voter's first choice does not register a viability level, then they will move to the voter's second choice. And if that candidate didn't reach a viability level, they will continue down the list until one of their candidates' choices reaches a viability level. I'm concerned that we might have an Iowa situation on our hands again, where we will get to tomorrow night and we will not have real results out of Nevada. But we will see. But folks, I wanted to tie the state of the Democrat race back to the issue we started this broadcast out off with, and we're going to get into more of the details on the Senate votes on the life issues in the next segment of the broadcast. But folks, I wanted to know if any of you noticed on Wednesday, when the Democrats were having their primary, one of the moderators, Hallie Jackson, I have to give her major congratulations because she was working that debate while 8.5 months pregnant. And I would just offer her and her family a sincere congratulations on their soon-to-be-born addition to their family. But I could not help but be struck by the irony of the situation where the child that was living inside of her is at a stage where we know conclusively that he or she could hear everything that was happening in that room. It's why the medical experts tell us that we should read to our children in utero. It's why they say that we should sing to our children in utero, because they are capable of hearing their surroundings. Now, the issue of abortion didn't come up during that debate. I thought that was tragic, but I was still struck by the irony that he or she was able to hear what was going on in that room, and there wasn't a single candidate on that stage that would have defended the right of him or her to exist in its in their current state inside the womb, just a week or two away from emerging from the womb. And Harry, I want to come to you on this, because the votes that are going to take place in the United States Senate on Tuesday actually illustrate that none of those six candidates would actually support that child's right to live after he or she emerged from the womb. So I wanted to issue a congratulations to Hallie Jackson for sort of dual tasking that, being 8.5 months pregnant and working the debate. But Harry, it is a tragic situation we find ourselves in when the Democrat primary field cannot even stand for the right of that child to exist after he or she has emerged from the womb.
I think that's correct. And I think it is also a testament to the fact that so many Democrats have taken so much money from Planned Parenthood and other outlets that are committed to radical human autonomy, which means, at least in some cases, they are committed to infanticide. And so earlier we talked about pending Senate legislation, the Pain-Capable Bill and the Born Alive Bill. Those two laws represent an advancement in the protection of life. And yet, both of those pieces of legislation are unable to attract a majority of Democrats. And so that's why state and local elections also matter during this presidential year.
No question about it. This debate about abortion, folks, it has moved past abortion now. Now we're talking about infanticide and the right to admit mothers to a hospital when she needs care. This has gotten really radical, really extreme. Look, I want to hear your phone calls. What do you think about the state of the Democrat race? What do you think about their position on life? Who do you think is going to win Nevada? What about South Carolina? Can Vice President Biden have that as its firewall? If you want to join the broadcast, 1-800-684-3110. We'll be back after this.
The challenges facing Americans are substantial. At a time when our values, our freedoms, our constitutional rights are under attack, it's more important than ever to stand with the American Center for Law and Justice. For decades now, the ACLJ has been on the front lines, protecting your freedoms, defending your rights, in courts, in Congress, and in the public arena. And we have an exceptional track record of success. But here's the bottom line. We could not do our work without your support. We remain committed to protecting your religious and constitutional freedoms. That remains our top priority, especially now during these challenging times. The American Center for Law and Justice is on your side. If you're already a member, thank you. And if you're not, well, this is the perfect time to stand with us at aclj.org, where you can learn more about our life-changing work. Become a member today, aclj.org. Only when a society can agree that the most vulnerable and voiceless deserve to be protected is there any hope for that culture to survive. And that's exactly what you are saying when you stand with the American Center for Law and Justice to defend the right to life. We've created a free, powerful publication offering a panoramic view of the ACLJ's battle for the unborn. It's called Mission Life. It will show you how you are personally impacting the pro-life battle through your support. And the publication includes a look at all major ACLJ pro-life cases, how we're fighting for the rights of pro-life activists, the ramifications of Roe v. Wade 40 years later, Planned Parenthood's role in the abortion industry, and what Obamacare means to the pro-life movement. Discover the many ways your membership with the ACLJ is empowering the right to life. Request your free copy of Mission Life today online at aclj.org/gift.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Jay Sekulow Live. We are going to move to the issue of politics and the Democrat primary, and also the position on life that has become more and more radical in Washington, D.C., inside the Democrat Party. I mean, a pro-life Democrat in the United States House is now basically an extinct thing. In the United States Senate, it looks like next week you're going to have a majority of the United States Senate on the Democrat side of the aisle actually vote in favor of what I would describe as infanticide, the denying of medical care to a child who is born alive and on the table. We will see. I hope I am wrong with that. I sincerely do. That should be an easy bipartisan vote. But we are going to move into that political discussion as well as a discussion around the two bills that the United States Senate is going to consider in just a moment. But I did want to take one more call that was coming in on this issue involving the International Criminal Court, sort of tie that issue in a bow. It's one that Jay covered extensively in the first half. But Ray from Arizona is calling in about that issue. So I wanted to get to his call. Ray, thank you for holding on. Welcome to Jay Sekulow Live.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. In my opinion, the International Criminal Court has absolutely no jurisdiction to determine that any Israelis or any American military people, for that matter, have committed war crimes. I wish they would just shut up and go away, you know?
Yeah, Ray, I certainly understand where you're coming from, and on the issue of jurisdiction, I agree with you. I mean, the International Criminal Court does not have jurisdiction in this area, but I actually think it goes a little bit further than that, and I would bring Harry into this discussion. I think it's ironic, Harry, that the Palestinians are essentially going to go to the International Criminal Court, and they are going to pretend that they've had a state since 2012. They're going to pretend that statehood has already been won. But Harry, when President Trump put out his proposed peace plan just a few weeks ago, they immediately rejected it and said, we will discuss this issue as soon as you immediately found a new Palestinian state. So I honestly think that's why these seven countries across the world are starting to walk away from the Palestinian position, because they are so duplicitous on this issue. On the one hand, they claim that they've had a state since 2012. On the other hand, they're rejecting out of hand a proposal from the United States for the two parties to agree, because they want the immediate founding of a state before they will engage that conversation. Harry, you can't have it both ways.
You can't. On the other hand, I think you have to hand it to the Palestinians in terms of their persistence in trying to have it both ways. And so here you have a situation where the ICC prosecutor is trying to get the court to agree to the creation of a state by fiat, even though the ICC lacks both the power and the legal authority to do so. And so this attempt, at least in my opinion, represents the elevation of what I call an aristocracy of grievance. And what that means is many members of the international community, they look at the state of Israel, a relatively prosperous state, a highly educated state, and then they look at the plight of the Palestinians, relatively poor, relatively backward, relatively uneducated, and they say these individuals, the Palestinians, have a legitimate grievance. So let's create a state, and that will solve their problems. What the members of the international community fail to understand is the creation of the state of Palestine will do very little to improve the lives of Palestinians. Why? Because many individuals in the Palestinian Authority operate what might be called a kleptocracy. They take international funds and then they refuse to share it with the Palestinian people. So the real problem in the territory of Palestine is the fact that the Palestinian Authority treats its own people very poorly, but then this creates grievances, and then the international community points the finger at the state of Israel, and some of these individuals in their international community, they want to create a state contrary to international law, contrary to the facts on the ground, contrary to the United Nations mandate, which converted the territory, then actually known as Palestine, into the state of Israel. And Israel is a sovereign state. All of the so-called disputed territories, or virtually all of them, were granted to the modern nation state of Israel in 1947.
Strikes me, Harry, that the Palestinian Authority would be much better served to actually come to the negotiating table. You've got both major parties in Israel who are vying for power, willing to negotiate. They should be engaging those conversations, but they're not doing it. Folks, I want to pivot now to politics and the state of the Democrat primary. We're going to discuss in the next segment of the broadcast these pro-life bills that are coming before the United States Senate next week. And I do want to talk about how these Democrat candidates are positioned on both of these votes. But first, I just kind of want to reset the stage for where we're at in this process. As we are on the eve of the Nevada caucuses, and I look at the Nevada polling, I would be really surprised, folks, if Senator Sanders does not win Nevada going away. I expect him to do it. And then there's only one race left before Super Tuesday, and that's, of course, South Carolina. That is the state in which Vice President Biden has insisted that he will win, and it will be his firewall. It will make him the alternative to Senator Sanders. When I look at the polling in South Carolina, I do think that the vice president has a chance in South Carolina. And honestly, I think Mayor Bloomberg's difficult performance on the debate stage probably boosted the vice president's chances in South Carolina. However, once you get past South Carolina, you absolutely have to have a war chest to compete going forward. You move quickly into Super Tuesday, where there are 16 states, many of them with very large delegate halls. I think about California, where if the polls are correct there, Bernie Sanders might win all 144 of the statewide delegates that are available, and then the vast majority of delegates that will be apportioned based on the district results. So you have to have a lot of money to compete on Super Tuesday. And as it exists right now, the vice president just doesn't have it. In fact, there are only two candidates with enough money to compete on Super Tuesday, and that would be Senator Sanders and Mayor Bloomberg. Everyone else is just about done, and they need an infusion of cash. So how could the vice president get an infusion of cash? Well, he would need to win a state. I'm just not sure that South Carolina comes soon enough, even if he wins it. South Carolina is on the last day of February 29th, And then Super Tuesday is March 3rd. So, Harry, before we get to the issue of life and how it is informing this Democrat primary, I just look at the finances of the race right now, and you're absolutely convinced that Senator Sanders is going to be the front runner going into Super Tuesday. You know that Mayor Bloomberg will have the funds to compete on Super Tuesday. We will see if that's enough to cover up his debate performance. But it looks to me like there's not another candidate that is able to compete financially. You know, maybe Senator Warren gets a boost from her debate stage, but I'm not sure she can take votes away from Senator Sanders anyway, and that's where she would need to take them from. I'm just interested from you, Harry. Do you see another candidate outside of those top two and maybe extending to the vice president who has a chance as we move towards Super Tuesday?
No, I don't. And I would add a caveat with respect to one of the top two candidates, Mr. Bloomberg. He needs an infusion of energy. And so I think you are absolutely correct that Joe Biden needs an infusion of money. And certainly if he wins in South Carolina, this may cause the money to flow in. I also think Elizabeth Warren made a strategic error in attacking Bloomberg so hard and allowing Sanders to go unscathed. And then I think Mayor Pete and Klobuchar, they managed to cancel each other out by engaging in a sincerely petty debate that accomplished very little, largely surrounding the name of the president of Mexico. If you can imagine spending 10 to 15 minutes of debate time talking about the importance of the name of the president of Mexico as opposed to policy issues. So I think Bloomberg can hang in there, but I don't see him blocking Sanders necessarily because no one takes him seriously, particularly no one takes him more seriously than his campaign commercials, and they are quite plentiful.
Well, the saving grace for the mayor might be that there will be a lot more people that will see his ads across these 16 states on Super Tuesday than were able to tune in to the debate the other night. If they saw the debate along with the ads, I would suspect that Senator Sanders would be well on his way. But Mayor Bloomberg has spent more than $400 million through the end of January. I'm telling you, that kind of money will make him viable on Super Tuesday. The question for me is, does South Carolina come along soon enough to give the vice president a chance? And even if it does he perform well enough, or does Senator Sanders catch him? I kind of think that Senator Sanders is going to win that state as well, and he'll head into Super Tuesday 4-0. We want to hear from you. 1-800-684-3110. Who do you think the Democrat nominee will be?
Only when a society can agree that the most vulnerable and voiceless deserve to be protected is there any hope for that culture to survive. And that's exactly what you are saying when you stand with the American Center for Law and Justice to defend the right to life. We've created a free, powerful publication offering a panoramic view of the ACLJ's battle for the unborn. It's called Mission Life. It will show you how you are personally impacting the pro-life battle through your support. And the publication includes a look at all major ACLJ pro-life cases, how we're fighting for the rights of pro-life activists, the ramifications of Roe v. Wade 40 years later, Planned Parenthood's role in the abortion industry, and what Obamacare means to the pro-life movement. Discover the many ways your membership with the ACLJ is empowering the right to life. Request your free copy of Mission Life today online at aclj.org/gift. The challenges facing Americans are substantial. At a time when our values, our freedoms, our constitutional rights are under attack, it's more important than ever to stand with the American Center for Law and Justice. For decades now, the ACLJ has been on the front lines, protecting your freedoms, defending your rights, in courts, in Congress, and in the public arena. And we have an exceptional track record of success. But here's the bottom line: we could not do our work without your support. We remain committed to protecting your religious and constitutional freedoms. That remains our top priority, especially now during these challenging times. The American Center for Law and Justice is on your side. If you're already a member, thank you. And if you're not, well, this is the perfect time to stand with us at ACLJ.org, where you can learn more about our life-changing work. Become a member today, ACLJ.org.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Jay Sekulow Live, Than Bennett in Washington, D.C. As we are on the eve of the Nevada caucus, I am very intrigued at how the issue of life and the radical position of Democrats in Washington, D.C. are shaping the primary. There are a couple of bills that are going to be on the floor of the United States Senate next Tuesday that really illustrate this very well. Before we talk about those, I want to play for you some sound from Senator Amy Klobuchar when she was asked if there is room for pro-life Democrats inside the party. And Jordan and I had a discussion on this earlier in the week about the difference between saying there is room for pro-life Democrats in the party and actually doing something to back that up. And I think the bills that are coming up on Tuesday will illustrate this. But I want you to hear directly from Senator Klobuchar on the issue, because she is one of the senators that can vote on these bills next week. So this is Senator Amy Klobuchar, Bite 17.
Well, first I say this, I'm strongly pro-choice. I have always been pro-choice, but I believe we're a big tent party, and there are pro-life Democrats, and they are part of our party, and I think we need to build a big tent. I think we need to bring people in instead of shutting them out, and that also includes independents right here in New Hampshire, as well as moderate Republicans.
So a couple of things. Harry, first of all, she says that she will take pro-life Democrats' votes, but it's very clear that she has not been with them in Washington, D.C. Her record by pro-life organizations is a zero, and her record from Planned Parenthood and NARAL and the others is a 100. So it's empty words, and I would just directly apply this to the two bills that we're going to be debating in the United States Senate next week and voting on. The first one is called the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. This is the one that bans abortions after a child in utero can feel pain conclusively, according to the medical community, at 20 weeks. Amy Klobuchar will vote against that, as I suspect will every Democrat, actually, in the United States Senate. Maybe there's hope for one or two. But then the second one is the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which isn't about abortion at all. It's about babies who are born alive and need medical care. The last time this one was up, it only got three votes from Democrat senators, Senator Casey, Senator Jones, and Senator Manchin. Even Tim Kaine voted against that bill for reasons that are confounding to me. But Harry, when I listen to Amy Klobuchar say this, and she says that there are pro-life Democrats and that there's room for a big tent, I don't see evidence of it in Washington, D.C. I hope I'm wrong, Harry, but I think there will only be three, maybe four Democrats to vote for this bill on Tuesday. That's not even about abortion. It's about caring for babies who are born alive.
I think your analysis is spot on. So Amy Klobuchar does not take, this is my own view, pro-life Democrats seriously. There is really no room for pro-life Democrats in the Democratic Party. Why? Because if you are actually willing to do something that affirms the views of pro-lifers, I think it's impossible to continue the position held by most Democrats in both the House and the Senate to oppose two laws that on their face vindicate life. So let's start with the second one, the Born Alive Bill. This does nothing to hamper abortion. This is a child that is born. This is a child that is outside of the womb. And essentially what Planned Parenthood and the pro-abortion crowd want is for the doctors to stand by and allow the child to essentially die. This was the position of Governor Northam, remember, in Virginia, in essentially supporting infanticide. Let's make sure that the child is comfortable And then let's talk to perhaps the parents. And essentially, if I understand Governor Northam's position correctly, then we allow the child to pass away. That is called neglect. And in most jurisdictions, it should be framed as criminal neglect. So rather than adopt any legislation that even tangentially supports the pro-life position, most Democrats are moving radically in the other direction.
Well, and it's why the bill that'll be considered on Tuesday in the United States Senate should be adopted, so that a child in that situation has the legal right to the same medical care that any other child would receive. Every senator of both parties should easily vote yes come next Tuesday. I want to go right to the phones. Let's go to Alan calling from South Carolina on line two. Alan, you've got a very important primary coming up. What do you think is going to happen there?
Trump will win again, I think. But the question I had is, President Trump has a great rapport, strong leadership with foreign nations. I can't see any of these Democrats at all possibly even representing our country strongly to these other nations. Joe Biden, he's shown his track record already. It's for financial gain. But who in the Democratic Party do you see would represent the values of the conservatives with our foreign nations?
Yeah, look, it's a good question, Alan. I mean, I don't think that you really have to speculate. I think each of the candidates have told us how they feel on this. They believe in a very different view from President Trump. And even the former vice president, who will say that he's got a lengthy track record on international affairs because of his time on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I think his time as serving for the for President Obama, serving as vice president, really illustrated that that is the foreign affairs approach that he takes now. So, Harry, just quickly, before we close the broadcast out, I think it's going to be very difficult for any of these candidates to make the case that some of the successes we've seen in the foreign affairs field would be carried on by these candidates. In fact, I think they'll openly tell you they support a view that's diametrically opposed to what President Trump has done.
I think that is correct. So I think all of the candidates on the stage are essentially cosmopolitan globalists. In other words, they support the elite position. And this means that they are prepared to surrender United States sovereignty, first on the issue of climate, second on the issue of the Iran nuclear deal, and third on the issue of human rights. And I would point out that Mayor Bloomberg is arguably one of the worst representatives of the human rights position, because he is willing to cave virtually completely, for instance, to his Chinese rulers. And so if you look at Bloomberg News, which operates in China, essentially Bloomberg News allows for Chinese censorship. In addition, he's probably willing to surrender to the Chinese on the issue of international trade. So there are no good options, I think, from the Democrats. Bloomberg may indeed be the worst.
Folks, I think within a couple of weeks, we will be down to two, maybe three candidates by Super Tuesday. I think Senator Sanders is well positioned to be the nominee, but we will see. But as we look towards next Tuesday, kudos to Leader McConnell for scheduling these two votes. And I would just issue a call to Democrat senators, senators like Tim Kaine, who have said that they are pro-life. When a baby is born alive, and abortion is no longer the option, we're talking about a baby born alive, will you cast a vote to allow medical care to be administered to that child? You will have the opportunity in the United States Senate on Tuesday.
For decades now, the ACLJ has been on the front lines, protecting your freedoms, defending your rights, in courts, in Congress, and in the public arena. The American Center for Law and Justice is on your side. If you're already a member, thank you. And if you're not, well, this is the perfect time to stand with us at ACLJ.org, where you can learn more about our life-changing work. Become a member today, ACLJ.org.